Hello, I'm Ken McLeod, Principal Teacher at Unfettered Mind. Our website is an ongoing effort to explain Buddhist practice in a way that is clear and accessible to the Western mind without dumbing it down. If you find these teachings useful, please make a donation at unfetteredmind.org/donate so we can continue to maintain and expand the site. Thanks.
Unfettered Mind. Heartbreak and suffering.
This is the fourth class, is it? Only two more left after this. Okay. Fourth class on the four immeasurables. And I believe the focus for practice over the last couple of weeks is compassion. Compassion being the wish that others not suffer, at least one level. And working with the four lines of may I be free from suffering, harm, and disturbance. May I be present with everything I encounter. May I experience the world wishing me freedom from pain. May I accept things just as they are. What was your experience with this? What questions, insights, challenges? Now I can see. Julia.
I had two experiences that were frequent and notable. One was heartbreak, and the other one was very strong movement of energy as I did the lines.
As you did the lines. Describe the heartbreak.
An increased awareness of the degree to which people suffer, and also a sense that for many people they may not have the means available to them to help them with their suffering.
Thich Nhat Hanh tells a story of an extremely bad-tempered woman in a village in Vietnam. We'll call her Mrs. Phong. And while she was very bad-tempered, she was also extremely devoted to Buddha Amitabha, who is the Buddha of compassion. And she would pray at the top of her voice to Amitabha every day for hours. People found in the village found this somewhat disturbing, and because she was so short-tempered, her noise pollution was creating a body of resentment in the community. And the elders met together to see, talk about what should be done. One of the elders said, "I know what to do, leave it to me." So the next day, when she is right in the middle of her prayers,
went over to her house and knocked on the door and said, "Mrs. Fung, I'd like to speak with you." There was no response. After a few minutes, he knocked again and said in a somewhat louder voice to be heard over her prayers, "Mrs. Fung, you know who it is. Please come down. I'd like to speak with you." And the only indication that there was any effect was an increase in the decibel level of the prayers. So finally he knocked very, very loudly and said, "Mrs. Fung, I really must speak with you. Please come down." The prayer stopped. There was the sound of a mala or rosary being slammed on the table. Stomp, stomp, stomp. The door was thrown open. Mrs. Fung said, "You are disturbing me at my prayers." And the elder looked at her and said, "I'm very sorry. Obviously you're very agitated by this and very disturbed. But I've only been calling you for a few minutes. Can you imagine how Buddha Amitabha must feel?" And what you say, Julia, is very much to the point. The immeasurables build on each other. Let me start with equanimity. And in equanimity, we come to the understanding, or through equanimity, we come to the understanding that everything everybody does, they do for one and one reason only. In that moment, they think that what they're doing or what they're saying is going to make their world a little happier or a little better. And of course, because of the confusion, it often has the absolutely opposite result. But that's why people do these things. To relieve some pressure internally or externally is just going to make things a little better, because they can't stand the way things are right then. Or they think maybe that's very good and they just want it to be a little better. And they ruin it by their action. But that's why they do things. That's why we all do things. Think it's going to make our world a little better. And in that way, a very profound way, we're all the same. And then in loving kindness, we connect with this deep yearning which drives our actions, and we want to be happy. We tend to make a mess of it because even though we want to be happy, we don't really see things very clearly, so the actions we do aren't really appropriate for the situation, so it makes a mess. And as we cultivate, as we come into touch with our own wish to be happy, it actually becomes quite easy to wish that others be happy too. Doesn't mean we have to like them. A lot of people confuse loving kindness and with liking. But there's a difference between liking people and wanting others to be happy. Then we come to compassion, which is the wish that others not suffer. And as we cultivate compassion, then as Julia describes, there's a heartbreak. Because in order to cultivate compassion, we have to see the suffering that is there. And we tend to see it not only in others, but also in ourselves. And the more intimately we become acquainted with our own suffering, the more clearly we understand that the process of suffering, how we create our suffering, operates exactly the same way in everybody else. Again, there's no difference. And now it's a very short step to that heartbreak, because we see and know how people are creating suffering for themselves all the time. And our heart goes out to them. And that heartbreak is not pity. It's not feeling sorry for others. Each of those sentiments has an element of separation, possibly an element of arrogance, superiority. In compassion, there is no sense of superiority. There is just being present with the pain and suffering, our own and others. And when we do that, we experience a broken heart. Now, Julie also made reference to energy. As we work with these practices, we are, through the taking in of these lines, breaking down the mechanisms of various habituated patterns. There's a great deal of energy locked up in those processes. So it's not surprising that as we experience, come to be present with the pain that is at the core of these patterns, and the patterns start to fall apart, all of that energy is released, becomes available to us. Comes available to our body, comes available to our emotions, it comes available to our attention and awareness. So there can be sensations of energy moving in the body, there can be very strong emotions arising for seemingly little reason, just things resonate more powerfully and more deeply. And we can also experience much greater clarity and understanding. All of these things arise quite naturally. Okay. Thank you, Julia.
It has to do with the line, may I be present with everything I encounter. This past weekend, I had a difficult conversation with someone, and that conversation was causing that other person to experience a great deal of pain and suffering. I realized that there was nothing I could do in that circumstance but just be there. I'm a little concerned that, although it felt like I was present, that that might have been masquerading as indifference.
It's a very deep question. A very practical question, too. The only I'm not sure that we can know, frankly. And some people say, and some people have told me, when you're really present, you know it, and that's that. That may be true. I can't say that I know that. But I do know, however, is that whenever the results in an interaction or a situation are different from our intention, then that's a de facto evidence that we are not present. Now, I think one of the more useful approaches here, and for me anyway, is what I call the black box theory. You've heard me talk about the world of individual experience. Uchiyama talks about it. And then when we look at the world or approach the world that way, there are no other people. There are experiences which arise, which for convenience sake, we label other people. There are these forms, these shapes, these sounds. And we put those all together and call this a person, and it's a convenient way. But there's really just our experience. From this perspective, we only have our own experience to work with. We cannot know what that other person is thinking or feeling, etc. You follow? And so the effort then is to be completely present in that world. Now, that's easy to fall into a kind of indifference. So when I say completely present, it means that we are able to perceive and respond to all of the subtle body language and might even say subliminal perceptions that arise. Because, you know, very small movements, and sometimes very quick movements, ones we may not register, our body or whole system registers, and we may not register them conceptually, but something in us registers them. So it means being present with all of that. And you act. You say what you have to say, and you see what the result is. And the result is happening moment by moment. So there's a constant adjustment moment by moment. As one's intention may, oh, well, that intention is not going to work at all, so now I need, because that's not this world. That was an idea. And so there could be a constant moving more and more into it, moment to moment. I think that's all we can do. Now, when I say that's all we can do, actually, it's quite a lot. I mean, when you're really doing that, it's quite extraordinary. But what more can we do?
I think I understand. What then does one do with the weight of, although you can't understand that other person's experience, if that other person tells you, I'm suffering.
Yes.
What does one do with the weight of that as a result of your action?
Let's take a short step back. You hear the words from the other person, I'm suffering. That precipitates an experience in you. What do you do with that experience?
I don't mean to sound glib. You do what you think is appropriate for that particular situation. Sometimes it's responding. Sometimes it's knowing you can't do anything.
Well, yes, but the first thing you do with that experience, you know, the person says, I'm suffering. And so there's this whole upwelling of emotion. I mean, particularly if it's a person you're connected to or have been connected to, and they say, you know, when I hear you say that, it just makes me feel terrible. And things like that. Now you're going to respond to that. There's a whole upwelling of experience. That's the experience you have to be present in first. Right there. That can be very, very hard. Because that can be pushing on all kinds of old conditioning in you. How you're always the cause of everybody's pain, etc. And all of these old stories come flooding up. And often the last thing we want to do is to be there, and we just want to make the other person feel better. I mean, it may be constructed in us that we're making the other person feel better because we actually do care about them, but part of it is coming from because we can't stand being with that experience inside. And part of the reason I'm going there is because one of the ways you characterize that experience is as weight, which suggests to me that what you're experiencing there is a heaviness, a load, a burden of some kind.
Heaviness, certainly. Load or burden, yeah. Not quite. It's just sort of the the sense that the other person is suffering, and just a...
Can you do anything about it?
No.
So, there's a person suffering, and you can't do anything about it. What do you experience there?
Sadness.
Yeah. Julia's heartbreak. Right? Yeah. That's compassion. And if you can be in that heartbreak and connected to that person at the same time, then what arises is what arises. That, I think, is all we can do. And that actually, I think it was Bonhoeffer, called that the I-Thou experience. I mean, it really has the qualities of presence, because you're present to what is arising outside you, and you're present to what is arising inside you. You're present in the whole thing. And what arises from that can be quite remarkable, wonderful, mysterious. Pick your word. Because there is, in many respects, a transcendence of the sense of self and the attachment to the self. But that only comes from being willing to let go of what one's holding on to inside. And it's in moments like these that we experientially appreciate or understand that there isn't a lot we can do to help others with their suffering, because so much of it is self-generated. This is the Bodhisattva's dilemma. And we all know this. We see the solution, but the other person, for whatever reason, can't see it, and even if they can see it, they can't do it, and even if they can do it, they can't keep doing it. And we can't do it for them, and so forth and so forth. Right? When you're getting down to this level, usually the pain and suffering that are being experienced aren't from the present situation. It's how the present situation is resonating, usually in both people, with old pains. And you didn't put those pains there, so you can't do anything about them. This is why in spiritual practice we say and we insist that all efforts are volitional. They have to come to the from the person themselves. You cannot possibly make anybody do this. It's just, you can create the environment, you can push, you can encourage, you can do whatever, but you can't actually make it do that. Everybody has to come to this their own way.
Okay. Leslie?
You can't make somebody deal with their own suffering.
What?
Deal with their own suffering. You can't make somebody want to wake up. It has to come from inside them. And there's a nun in England that I met some years ago. Many of you met her. I've met her. Venerable Tanasanti. And she's a Southern California girl. She's a kick. But she's just finished a three-month retreat in England. Winter retreat at her at the center where she lives. And I guess around the beginning of January or so, we were talking on the phone, and she was describing in words that are very familiar to me, going through pain that she wouldn't wish upon her worst enemy. And I can resonate with that, because in my own practice, sometimes it is so very painful to meet the conditioning and what's behind the conditioning in us that you really wouldn't want to wish it on your worst enemy. And I've always found that very interesting, because